On this episode of Still Loading, the history of RTS games part 2. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval. Today's mini-episode is a continuation of the History of RTS Games series that I've been working on. The first episode was a bit of a dry run, so I'm tweaking some things slightly this time around, and hopefully it will improve this week's dive into RTS history. For those new to this series, I'm doing a deep dive on the history and evolution of the RTS real-time strategy genre, and each part in this series will be released as the second mini-episode each month. I do lay out some groundwork on the specifics of what I will be covering throughout the series in part one, so if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and check it out. In any case, on to the show. I concluded part one talking about the extremely important game Utopia, the first true ancestor to what would become the RTS genre. Today's episode, I'm beginning with a game from 1982 called Citron Masters. Citron Masters was developed for the Atari 8-bit computer family and the Apple II by Ozark Software. The designer of the game was Dan Bunton, later known as Danielle Bunton Berry. It's important to know that Bunton Berry used male pronouns when referring to her pre-transition self. She transitioned in 1992, so any games I talk about that she worked on prior to that, I will use male pronouns when referring to her, as that's what she did too. And if you'd like to understand her use of pronouns further, I will include a link to the article in the show notes so you can understand further as well. Citron Masters was interesting because it had elements of both real-time tactics games and real-time strategy games. This was once again a game where both players would appear on the same screen at once. However, unlike Sea Battle, which I mentioned in part 1, both players could see the commands each other were entering as they appeared on screen, which in a sense also makes the game similar to chess, since in chess you can see all the quote-unquote commands your opponent issues during their turn, but unlike chess, this game was played in real time. Each player has a command center, a transport beam, and four power centers on their side of the screen, eight total power centers between the two players. These power centers provide resources for players to spend on building new units called citrons. The power centers cannot be destroyed, however, they can be captured to provide additional resources to the player who captures it. There are five different types of citron units total: shooters, mines, bunkers, missiles, and commanders. The players can then control each citron and direct them in battle. Victory is earned by the player who can destroy their opponent's command center. Admittedly, it was hard at first to decipher the mechanics of Citron Masters. I found gameplay videos of it online, but there was no narration, so I was watching the gameplay without the context of what each player's abilities are or what they do. For example, the four basic commands a player can choose from in the game are make, direct, order, and locate. Without the context of what each command did, it was hard to understand what purposes they served. Make was easy enough to figure out. It's the command the player uses to create new units. However, commands direct and order confused me at first, because in my mind, when you issue a command to someone, you are directing them to do something. Similarly, direct and locate confused me because I assumed that direct meant the direction the unit was moving, and locate meant indicating a location to move to. I was very confused, to say the least. Thankfully, there are many amazing resources online that uploaded a PDF of the original manual of the game, and it clarified everything. The purpose and function of each of the commands is as follows. Make. Make is the command the players use to create their new units, just as I had originally thought. Direct. Direct is the command players use to control individual units. The direct command allows players to tell a unit to advance or retreat, i.e. moving left or right, or move north and south, i.e. up or down. And lastly, they could command them to halt or self-destruct. Order. Order is unique. It allows players to move groups of units instead of having to individually move each one. The way this works is the player must first create a commander unit. When the player gives that commander unit a move order, any other citrons within 3 pixels of that commander will also follow the same move order. This is honestly a really cool step forward to me in the RTS genre. One of the staples of modern RTS games is being able to move groups of units at once to attack or defend, and while it's not quite there in Citroen Masters, it does show signs of what was to come. And the last command was locate. Locate is used to determine the spawn location of newly created Citroens. The biggest innovation to me in this game was the player's ability to create and modify group compositions. If you remember in the last episode of this series, you could move groups of units in Sea Battle. However, where Sea Battle and Citroen Masters differs is in Sea Battle, once you create a group of units, the composition of that group could not be modified. You couldn't later combine groups or add slash remove units within it. In Citroen Masters, since the grouping is determined by a unit's proximity to a commander, you could change up your group composition to whatever you wanted. The next game I want to talk about is Legionnaire. Legionnaire was created by Chris Crawford in 1982 for the Atari 8-bit computer family. It was also released on the Apple II and Commodore 64. I had never actually heard of Crawford before doing research for this, and learning more about him, I feel like I could do an entire episode on him. But to keep it brief so we can stay focused on the games, I'll give you two tidbits of info on him that I found really interesting. First, he was one of the co-founders of GDC, the Game Developers Conference, which is now an annual, gigantic, important event for all game developers to meet and talk about game design. The second thing I thought was interesting was in 1992, he withdrew from commercial game development to focus on experimentation with the next generation of storytelling. In 2018, that's right, 26 years later, he announced he had stopped working on those experiments because he determined that civilization needed centuries to embrace the required concepts. I have no idea what that means, which is why I want to do some more research on him and find out. But enough about him. Let's dive into his game, Legionnaire. Legionnaire was a huge step forward in the RTS genre, though admittedly this game is still more of a real-time tactics game, as it does not have any resource collection or management. In the game, players control Julius Caesar's Roman legions as they fight their barbarian enemies. This was the first game in my RTS series that I could find that featured a historical backdrop to the in-game action. The game was only semi-historical, though, as it does not include any real-life historical events, and only vaguely revolves around Julius Caesar's military campaigns. But what makes Legionnaire stand out is the addition of a bunch of new core mechanics, most of which have since become staples of the RTS genre. First is screen scrolling. Players control an orange box, which acts as a cursor that they can move around to select units. When the cursor gets to the edge of the screen, the map will scroll to reveal new areas. Up until this point, the entire map was always visible to the player on the screen, both players if it was multiplayer. Legionnaire is the first game that I could find that made maps larger than the screen and allowed players to scroll around to explore all of it. At the beginning of the game, the player has a chance to inspect the whole map to get a sense of where all the enemies have spawned and where their own units have spawned, which in turn gives them a chance to strategize before the game starts. When units move across the map, they actually would move slower when marching through woods or mountains versus on flat plains. Another new feature related to the map in this game was the addition of height slash elevation to the game maps. Games previously mentioned had trees or islands, but they all functioned as if they existed on a perfectly flat world. Legionnaire added height, quote-unquote, to the game by using different color lines to mark different terrain elevations. Units positioned at a higher elevation gain a combat advantage against those at a lower one. This leads into the second big addition, tactical combat advantages. Besides the uphill combat bonus, there was also combat bonuses for flanking an enemy. However, this could only be achieved if the unit was moving. If they were standing still, they would simply turn and face your oncoming attack. Besides just position-based advantages, there was also energy-based ones, meaning your units could fatigue and in turn would be less effective in battle. The player's legions get fatigued by movement, and to recover, they need to stop moving for a period of time. This encouraged the player to be more strategic in how they enter combat. Running headfirst into battle would not be a wise decision, as all their troops would be tired from the march. The fatigue and recovery system seems like it might be the predecessor to the health bars that you now see in modern RTS games. In combat, the less energy slash more fatigued a unit is, the less likely it will be able to survive the battle. Similarly, in modern games, the less health a unit has, the least likely they will be to survive a battle. The final big addition is different army slash civilizations slash tribes. This is a mainstay of modern RTS games, as most games now boast numerous civilizations slash races that all have unique attributes. This is the earliest game that I could find that had this mechanic. In Legionnaire, there are 10 different Legion types for the players to command. These act more like different unit types versus actual civilizations. However, it's not quite as simple as that, because while the 10 different legions all have different strengths and weaknesses, you can only control how many legions you get to command. You can't choose which legions they are, so you could end up with some of the weaker ones versus some of the stronger ones. Barbarians have a bit more variety. There are a total of 16 barbarian tribes, all with unique attributes. The 16 tribes are organized into two groups of 8, 8 infantry tribes and 8 cavalry tribes. When a player is setting up the game, they choose how many legions they want to command and which barbarian tribes they wish to face. What is weird is that players can choose which legions they are fighting with, but they can choose which tribes they are fighting against. One last note on Legionnaire that I thought was cool. In the manual for the game, they break down the entire history, or at least a portion of, Julius Caesar's military campaigns against the barbarians by date, which I thought was a cool little touch to add in the manual. So far in this series, Legionnaire seems to resemble modern RTS games the most. This game is generally considered to be the first true real-time tactics game, so we have a bit of a ways till we hit that first true RTS. So, on to the next one. Ocean Battle, released in 1982. I'm not going to touch on this one much at all. It's basically a clone of Sea Battle from 1980, which I talked about in part 1. The only reason I'm mentioning this game is because it was released on a console I had never heard of prior to researching this, the Arcadia 2001. This console came out in 1982 and was manufactured by Emerson Radio, of all companies. I love this era of game history where companies that weren't specific to games saw Atari success and basically said, fuck it, I can do that, i.e. the ColecoVision from Coleco, otherwise known as the Connecticut Leather Company. Okay, now on to the next actual game that I think is worth talking about, Bokosuka Wars. Bokosuka Wars was designed by Koji Sumo for the Sharp X1 computer in 1983. It later received ports for the more famous MSX as well as the Famicom. The game was never released outside of Japan, and the game isn't, in the strictest sense, an RTS. It's defined by Wikipedia as an action strategy role-playing game, and while it is all of those things, it also has some RTS elements in it. So even though this isn't the best example of an RTS, and arguably is farther away from being an RTS than some of the games I mentioned previously, I wanted to include it on this episode for two reasons. One, it's the first Japanese game in this genre that I could find. And two, since it's an RPG, it did add RPG elements to the genre, something you really didn't see often in these games until the mid-2000s. In Bokosuka Wars, you control King Shuren, trying to move your army across the screen and battle King Agareth's armies. Victory is achieved once the player marches their way across the screen and defeats King Agareth. There are a total of 3 unit types for the player to control, a pawn/soldier, a knight, and the king himself, King Shuren. The controls are not user-friendly from what I could see. When you move Shuren around, you also move all of your units. You can manually select what type of unit you want to control, and it will then move all of that same unit type, but you cannot control individual units. This makes movement incredibly difficult, as there is a lot of trees and rocks and other obstacles that will impede your unit's progress, causing you to have to stop completely to get them around it. When an enemy collides with one of your units, a small battle ensues. You'll see some flashing icons, and the unit that won will remain and the other will disappear. If one of your units wins enough battles, it will level up and become stronger, hence the RPG elements I mentioned earlier. It's important to note that computer versions of this game are different from the Famicom version. In the original computer versions, King Shuren begins the game with his entire army and has to march them across the battlefield. Along the way, there may be some of his units that are captured and that you can free by touching them. In the Famicom version, you start with only King Shuren and no army. You have to find the rest of your army by running into random trees and rocks and hoping they were just your soldiers in disguise all along. You all may think that I'm kidding, but that's actually true. You build an army by running into shit. It's wild. Okay, that's all I got on that game. So the next one of note is NATO Commander from 1983, also for the Atari 8-bit family of computers. There's a lot of these games for that system. This game didn't bring a whole lot new to the table. Graphically, it was arguably not as good as other games that came out around the same time. On a personal level, I found watching the play of it visually confusing. Units are largely represented by X's and O's instead of symbols that represent their unit types. But there were a few exceptions to this. There are various unit types such as infantry, tanks, airborne troops, etc., but it was hard for me to really get a grasp of them from what I watched. If anyone is a fan of this game and would like to teach me more about it, I would be very appreciative. I would honestly love to learn more about it because it was so hard to understand what the game was really like during the course of my research. What this game does do that's interesting is it added political scenarios. Instead of the same battle setup each time, you could choose various scenarios in which each presented a unique setup and challenge. In the game, the player controls the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO's forces in Europe, who has to stave off a Warsaw Pact attack. If you don't know what the Warsaw Pact is, look up your history books. Regardless of the scenario, what's interesting is that your goal as NATO commander isn't necessarily to wipe out the enemy, but to slow them down and try to resolve things diplomatically. So, while NATO commander didn't bring much new in terms of gameplay, it did change the game win conditions to something other than annihilation of the enemy, which was an interesting new idea for the time. You could also nuke your opponent, but that tended to put a damper on the whole diplomatic outcome. And did I mention this game was designed by Sid Meier, a pre-Civilization Sid Meier? Anyway, on to the next one. The next game on the list is Stonkers for the ZX Spectrum. For those who don't know, the ZX Spectrum, or ZX Spectrum if you're from the States like me, was an 8-bit personal home computer that was popular predominantly in the UK in the 80s. It did see a North American release, but it didn't fare as well here in the States as it did with our friends across the pond. In Stonkers, the player controls 16 units that goes up against the computer, which also controls 16 units. The entire battlefield is shown on screen, however, players have to select an area to zoom into so they can see and control the units. There are four different types of units for players to control: infantry, tanks, artillery, and supplies. Three out of the four units require supplies to be able to move and fight. To resupply them, the player must send their supply units to keep them reinforced. They almost act as medics, but instead of health, it's keeping the unit supplied. What makes Stonkers stand out to me compared to the other games mentioned here is its simplicity and control. The game was mostly played with a joystick and one button. You move the cursor around with the joystick and select a unit by hitting the button. You can then direct that unit to move or attack with that same button. The other games mentioned here have fairly complex control schemes, but Stonkers really simplified it and made it much more accessible for those who would have been confused by the controls of the other games. Stonkers also had a bit of a graphical upgrade compared to the other games mentioned on this list, but that is nothing compared to what the final game we are talking about today, The Ancient Art of War. The Ancient Art of War was developed by Everywhere, published by Broderbund, and released for the Apple II and MS-DOS in 1984. The title of the game is based off the famous book written by Sun Tzu. I try to close out each episode in the series with a game that took a large leap forward in the RTS genre, and this game, like Utopia in the last episode, really exemplifies that. The Ancient Art of War adds so many features and functions that are now found in modern RTS games, it's crazy. But before we go into that, let me briefly go over what this game does that we have seen before. On the battlefield, icons represent groups of units that you can control in battle. When one of your icons on the map goes into battle with an enemy unit, you can zoom into that battle and see what the individual units in that group are doing. There are three main types of units that you can battle with: knights, barbarians, and archers. The game relies on a simple rock-paper-scissors style of tactics. Knights are strong against barbarians are strong against archers, and archers are strong against knights. In a battle, you can control individual unit types. For instance, you can direct all the knights to attack or retreat, or all the barbarians to attack or retreat, etc., etc. Your enemy's army type/composition is determined by which general you select at the beginning of the game. There are also different terrain effects. Units that had high ground have a tactical advantage to the ones fighting up at them. Units that have the high ground have a tactical advantage to the ones fighting up towards them. A lot of these mechanics we have seen in other games mentioned previously in the series, but now since you have a basic overview of the game, let me tell you what this game does that is new to the genre. Let's first start with some of the improvements to the existing mechanics that I mentioned above. There is actually a fourth unit type, so it's not just the three. There is a fourth unit type that I didn't mention before called spies. Spies cannot fight in combat, but they can see enemy units twice as far away, effectively making them the earliest instance that I could find of scouting in the genre. Scouting is an important part of RTS games now, and up until this point, I hadn't seen any of the games covered have this feature in them. Another improvement is when you select a unit to move or fight, you can actually choose a formation for the soldiers in that unit, which gives you different tactical advantages or disadvantages depending on the formation slash composition of the enemy group of units. There were also more land slash terrain types that provided tactical advantages. It was not just fighting on the higher ground anymore. There were villages and forts on the map, some with walls, which made it impossible for any other unit other than archers to attack. The battle backgrounds, when you zoomed in to the battles, were also very diverse. Even if a battle was occurring on the same terrain type, the background would change. It, of course, also changed if you're fighting in a fort compared to a forest or on the plains. There is also a version of resources in this game, similar to Stonkers, in that you need to resupply your units. Where this game differs from Stonkers is that instead of sending supply units to your soldiers, you must control towns to provide more resources to your soldiers. The more towns you capture, the easier it is for you to resupply, while simultaneously making it more difficult for the enemy to resupply. The Ancient Art of War also had scenarios similar to what Legionnaire did, but these scenarios were slightly different and they offered a larger variety of challenges for the players. For example, here are just three examples of the scenarios that are listed in the game manual. In the Race for the Flag scenario, in the abandoned fort in the north, there are two flags, one white and one black. The first squad to the fort wins the war. Sound easy? Well, you're greatly outnumbered and a horde of Mongolian warriors are between you and the fort. In the Contest of the Gods scenario, it says, this is a race through the forest, two of your soldiers against two enemy soldiers. Do you try to cut the enemy off or outrun them? In the last scenario I'll mention, even though there are many more, the Elusive Spy. You're outnumbered 100-1, so use what strength you have against the enemy's weakness. And there are so many other scenarios listed, and like I said, I only read three of them. But now we get to the good part. New things added to the game that we had not seen in games that I have previously mentioned. The Ancient Art of War added rule customization. Before the beginning of each match, the player can change certain variables that affect the gameplay. For example, they can choose how frequently units are created, what the starting condition of their soldiers are. Are they weak or are they strong? Are they well supplied? Where the food supply actually comes from in the first place, whether it comes from towns or forts or both. There even seems to be some sort of a primitive fog of war. I couldn't quite get an idea of it because I couldn't see any gameplay examples of it. But it gives the option for the enemy to not always be seen. I haven't been able to find an explanation of this to see if this really is like Fog of War or not. Not even the game's manual explains this setting. But regardless, the rules customization feature it added gave the player a bit more control over the difficulty of the match. And arguably the biggest new feature is the addition of a custom campaign slash map maker, and it was a fairly robust one at that. Players could pick from an extensive tile set to create the geography of their maps. They could create an army and customize its configuration. They could choose the enemy general to face. They could set the rules of the match, and they also had a section for them to write the story of their campaign. And even with all that mentioned, I feel like I'm just barely skimming the surface of how much depth there is in the gameplay of the Ancient Art of War. But sadly, we have reached the end of part two of the series. I honestly want to cover more games in this episode, but seeing how much I'm recording now, it's actually pretty long in the first place. So before I go into my plugs, there's one last thing I wanted to comment on about the games that I've talked about today specifically. I mentioned it before in Legionnaire, but it also a version of this is found in the Ancient Art of War. For some reason, there are large sections in the manuals for both these games, and I'm sure there's other games that do this too, where it's devoted to actual history lessons. In Legionnaire, like I mentioned before, there's a portion of the manual dedicated to listing the dates of the major wars and military campaigns of Julius Caesar. In the Ancient Art of War, there's a section called A Brief History of War Through the Ages, and I just love the attention to detail that these devs put into these games, even down to making sure the players knew the historical context of the historical fiction that was portrayed in gameplay. And that should do it for this episode of Still Loading. Thank you all so much for listening. As usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Still Loading Pod on all of them. If you want to reach out to me, you can email me at stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, the easiest way to do that is give it a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That helps more people find the show, and you honestly don't know how much that helps me. If you want to support the show monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. And of course, the most important shout out I always end off with, the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that is all I have for you today. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying this history of the RTS genre as much as I am, and I will see you all next time.